To all. This is our final week in our series of studies we've been doing over how to study the Bible, and today we're going to have another kind of test passage we're going to be looking at. And I do have a handout which has today's text, which is 2 Samuel chapter 7 on the front, and then Wednesday, Isaiah chapter 7 on the back. And I'll see if Mr. Copeland will pass the... No, just pass them out if anyone needs one. If anybody needs one, just raise your hand and I'll get Mr. Copeland to pass them out for me. You'd like to do that? So a lot of you would have had this already from last week, but just raise your hand if you need one. And as long as we have copies, we'll make use of them. And to those of you who happen to be in my Old Testament history and geography class, you're going to be way ahead of the game here because... This is one of the most critical texts in all of the Old Testament. That's really one of the reasons I chose it for this class that we're doing. But it kind of does double duty. It'll help you in understanding really what's going on in the Old Testament a great deal. And so turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. We'll focus on verses 8 through 16. And... get around to answering the questions here. Now, next week, we'll be starting a couple of new studies. Jeremy's going to be leading us through a study of kind of a overview of church history from a biblical perspective. And then Nathan's going to begin a class on Old Testament archaeology, and both of which are very, very interesting. So let's look here at 2 Samuel chapter 7. The context here is that David wanted to build a temple for God. He thought, you know, I live in a nice palace and the Ark of the Covenant's stuck in this tent that's been around for hundreds of years. We ought to build something more permanent now that we're all settled in the land and Jerusalem is chosen as the city of God, and this is the place where his name will dwell. And so he mentioned this to Nathan the prophet. He said, "Hey, I want to build a temple." And Nathan said, "Sounds like a good idea to me." Apparently, without consulting the Lord. And so the Lord told Nathan later on. He said, "You go back to David and tell him I don't want him to build me a temple." And so picking up in verse 8, he says, "Now therefore, thus you will say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all of your enemies from before you." And the first question I ask on the paper is, what are the different things that God promises in connection with this promise to David, or set of promises to David? So as we begin here, you might either mentally or literally be taking note of the various things that God promises here. I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again, nor will the wicked afflict them anymore as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your seed after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever." All right, so what are some things that Nathan tells David here specifically God's going to do for him, or different aspects of this promise? Okay, instead of David building a temple for God, this seed of David is going to be the one that's going to wind up building the temple. There's a play being made here on the word house. David wanted to build a house for God, meaning a temple. And God said, well, no, I'm going to build you a house. Well, was God going to build David a temple? No. Was he going to build him a palace to live in?
Yes.
No, he already had that. What was he going to give him? A dynasty, we would typically say in English, a line of kings, a house, a family of royalty. And so I'm going to build you this dynasty, this type of house. Okay, what else does he say? Okay, it's going to be a kingdom that's going to be established. I'm going to establish a kingdom. Whether you count those as two things or just repeating the building of a house, you know, we're not going to quibble about that. What else?
Free from
okay, going to give you rest from your enemies. This is a very important word because God had promised rest to the people. There was a sense in which they received rest when they entered into the promised land in the time of Joshua. But there was another sense in which they had not fully enjoyed the rest that God promised. And so the establishment of this kingdom of David is going to be yet another development of that rest promise. And of course, the Hebrew writer will argue the real rest hasn't even come yet because neither Joshua nor David provided the ultimate rest that God has always had in mind, which of course the Hebrew writer will say is heaven. But this is a development and application of that promised rest, the land promise. What else does he say?
Throne will be established
forever. Okay, and there's several things we can kind of, his throne, his house, his kingdom, particularly in verse 12 and 13, and again in verse 16. So that gets emphasized quite a bit. Anytime something like that's repeated, it's kind of really underscores emphasis. Okay, first of all, Lawson.
Solomon was he obeyed God when he was young.
Okay. So, now what does that have to do with this? Who is Solomon?
Well, he said he would be my son.
Okay. So Solomon is David's son, so that may have some bearing. Okay, then, Shane. Okay, so when this seed of David disobeys, sins, he's going to be corrected?
My comment was stolen.
Okay, all right. Well, that's sometimes happens, but, you know, great minds think alike. So, what else? We pretty much hit most of these. Okay, he starts out by saying in verse 9, I will make your name great. Now, as soon as he says that, you ought to think immediately of another place in the Bible where God said he was going to make somebody's name great.
Abraham.
And that's not an accident because there's also another word that connects the promise to David and the promise to Abraham. And that's the word seed, you know. Through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And now we have this seed of David. And these are not two separate promises because obviously David was himself the seed of Abraham. What it really is a narrowing of the Abrahamic promise down. You know, what God told Abraham is through your seed, however many that might be, I'm going to bring a great blessing to the world. And when you say, well, what's this great blessing? And as I like to say, a large screen TV might be a blessing. You know, given what's on TV these days, it might not be. But you say, oh, well, is that the blessing? But you have to measure a blessing relative to people's problems. And if our problem was we've got bad plumbing, then the great blessing would be good plumbing. If our problem is I don't have a decent TV, then a blessing would be, hey, I got a great TV now. But man's problem is what? Sin. And so if this blessing comes to the world, it must be the remedy or solution to the problem of sin. And that is what it is. But now we discover that God's narrowing this promise down. It's actually going to be accomplished through a single descendant of Abraham and also David, who will be a king who will sit upon his throne. And ultimately, as you might guess, that's going to be Jesus. And there's one more thing here that's promised, and it's kind of interesting. We've saved it for last because this is just my own human judgment, but it is, I think, the most significant of all of these. It's kind of the heart of the promise in verse 14. I will be a father to him, and he will be my son. It illustrates that the nature of this relationship God will have with this descendant of David is a very close, it's personal, it's not just an economic arrangement or something like that. I will be like a father to him, and he will be like a son to me. And that also ties in with what Shane mentioned. Just like a father does, your son gets out of line, you correct him out of your love for him. And so there's a lot of elements to this promise here. And that leads us then to ask the question, who is the fulfillment of this promise? And I've already said Jesus is. You might conclude that just from the overall big picture of what this promise is about and how you know the Bible unfolds and what the New Testament says. But of course, the passage is explicitly quoted in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 5. As a series of quotations from the Old Testament. So to which angel did God ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you? The quotation from Psalm 2, or I will be a father to you and you will be my son, which is a quotation from 2 Samuel 7:14. Now, presumably the Hebrew writer could have quoted this whole section I have on the PowerPoint, but he lifts out of it one element of it particularly, which is verse 14, and that's perhaps part of the reason I suggest it is kind of the heart of the promise that God has given here. So it's fulfilled in Jesus. Now here's the problem. A lot of people, when they hear the English word fulfill, they think something like it's been filled full. And once you've filled something up full, there's just no more filling to go, right? You filled your gas tank with gasoline. That's it. I can't put any more gasoline in. It's just going to run out on the ground and I'm wasting good money. If I promise to give you $20 next week and next week rolls around and I give you $20, I've kept my promise, right? And are you going to come back the following week and expect me to give you another $20? Well, if you know me, you don't even expect the first $20, much less the second. But that's not how we perceive promises and their fulfillment. But in the Bible, it's quite different. That these prophecies have what we might call applications and multiple applications. And this, of course, could be one of two things. I'm just completely making this up, you know, and you believe it because I say so. I don't want anyone doing that. So this passage is probably the easiest way to demonstrate that that's what's going on with so many of these prophecies in the Old Testament. Because there's no doubt that it's fulfilled in Jesus because the passage is quoted and applied to Jesus in Hebrews chapter 1. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, this, if you turn to 1 Chronicles 17, you find the chronicler's parallel to 2 Samuel chapter 7. And so you have the version as it's recorded in 1 Chronicles 17. But then, just five chapters later, in 1 Chronicles 22, we have David's explanation of who the fulfillment of this promise is. Verse 6, he called for his son Solomon, charged him to build a house for the Lord God of Israel. David said to Solomon, my son, I had intended to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But God said no, basically. Verse 9, a son will be born to you who shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side, for his name will be Solomon. One of the few Hebrew words most everybody knows is shalom. So you can see the similarity with Sholomo, which is Solomon's name. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name. He shall be my son. I will be his father. I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. So, again, one or two possibilities. David thought Solomon was the fulfillment of the promise, and he was completely wrong about that. Or David is correct that Solomon is his seed, and he is the one who will build the house for God, and he will have his throne established and have this father-son kind of relationship with God and so on. Now, if you take the standard kind of approach to fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, we would be told, well, you need to pick. You know, either it's Solomon or it's Jesus. It can't be both. You know, God couldn't have been talking about both. Well, yes, he can. Because God is establishing a model, a role of king, and he calls different people to step into that role. Just like you might have the role in a play. And you have this character step in and try to play that part, and he may do a terrible job, and someone else may do a very good job, but none of them are the ultimate real McCoy. And so you think of all the roles God has established and all the patterns that he's developed in the Old Testament, prophet, priest, king, and they all point to Jesus. But they were all filled by different individuals who were called to step into that role and be the priest, be the prophet, be the king. And so Solomon is one of these. He's called to step into the role of king, and to the extent he serves as a king, does what a king's supposed to do, he illustrates the kind of king Jesus will be. When he steps out of that role and sins, you know, he's not living up to his responsibilities, then he is a reminder of how far we fall short of God's perfect standard. And it points to the need of a better king, a greater king, an ultimate king, the true king that will be Jesus. And so there are two passages that tell us who fulfills this promise. And then there's a third passage we can turn to in Psalm 89. Psalm 89. And the problem with Psalm 89 is we don't know when it was written. Reading between the lines, so to speak, it appears that something really tragic has happened to the nation of Judah. If I were to guess, it's probably the Babylonians have come and destroyed the nation and carried the king off into captivity. That's certainly the worst thing that ever happened to the people of Judah. And it presents them with this big theological problem. God promised that the throne of David would endure forever. There would never lack a man to sit on the throne of David. That God would never remove his loving kindness from the house of David like he did from Saul. And yet, we get to a point in the history of Judah where there is no king sitting on the throne of David. The king is carried off into captivity, and after him, there are no kings of Judah any longer. And you can imagine people would be thinking, well, what happened to God's promise? What in the world is God doing? And Psalm 89 is a meditation on that, and it sounds very pointed, very hard. I mean, it'd probably make a lot of us uncomfortable to ever try to talk to God this way. But we need to keep a couple of things in mind, that the ultimate purpose of the psalmist is he's focusing his faith in God. He's not giving up on God. If he did, he'd be writing a psalm to Baal or something. But he still has his faith in God. He's still looking to God for the answers. Now, he's puzzled about what God's doing. He doesn't know what the answer is, but he knows that God is still the one that has the answer to the problem. And you always have to keep that in mind. And so I will sing of the loving kindness of the Lord forever. To all generations I will make known your faithfulness with my mouth. For I have said loving kindness will be built up forever. In the heavens you will establish your faithfulness. And so he starts out by affirming, I have no doubt of the loving kindness of the Lord and that he is faithful. He keeps his promises. I don't want anyone to doubt that at all. Okay? And here is the specific thing that God has promised. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to David my servant. I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. Now that very clearly is practically a quotation from 2 Samuel chapter 7. And then you get this exalted description of the greatness of God. The heavens will praise your wonders, O Lord. Verse 10, you yourself crushed Rahab like one who is slain. This is not Rahab from the book of Joshua. This is the great sea serpent, the enemy of God. It's a figure. It's not, it wasn't a literal snake here. But you scattered your enemies with your mighty arm. The heavens are yours. The earth also is yours. You know, again, it's just constant praise and exaltation of God, right? Then picking up in verse 19, once you spoke in vision to your godly ones and said, I have given help to one who is mighty. I've exalted one chosen from the people. I have found David my servant. With my holy oil I have anointed him. And of course the word anoints related to the word Messiah. He's the anointed one of God. With whom my hand will be established, my arm also will strengthen him. The enemy will not deceive him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him. But I shall crush his adversaries before him and strike those who hate him. My faithfulness and my loving kindness will be with him, and in my name his horn will be exalted. I shall also set his hand on the sea and his right hand on the rivers. He will cry to me, you are my Father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. I also shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. You see how these get embellished and developed here. My loving kindness I shall keep for him forever, and my covenant shall be confirmed to him. And so I will establish his seed forever and his throne as the days of heaven. So it's a rehearsal again of just the emphatic nature of the promise that God has made to David. Okay. Now he begins turning his attention in a different direction here. It's still part of 2 Samuel 7. So verse 30, if his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. But I will not break off my loving kindness from him, nor deal falsely with my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His seed shall endure forever, and his throne is the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, and the witness in the sky is faithful. And so he acknowledges, I know there was this one clause in the promise that said if we mess up, particularly if the king sins, that we'll get chastised. And that chastisement might even be severe. But it would not be overwhelmingly, catastrophically put an end to the line of David and the rule of the throne of David and so on. That's the promise. But now notice verse 38. So all of that's kind of preparatory. That's not the problem. We get to the problem beginning in verse 38. So I have no doubt God is faithful, and in his faithfulness he's made a specific promise to David. It even includes the promise of chastisement if we sin. All that's fine. I have no problem with that. But you have cast off and rejected. You have been full of wrath against your anointed one. You have spurned the covenant of your servant. You have profaned his crown in the dust. You've broken down all his walls. You've brought his strongholds to ruin. All who pass along the way plunder him. He's become a reproach to his neighbors. You have exalted the right hand of his adversaries, and you have made all his enemies rejoice. See, that language is the opposite of what the prophets said. God will exalt your hand and crush your enemies, but it seems like the other way around. The hand of his enemies is exalted, and he is crushed. You also turned back the edge of his sword, have made him not to stand in battle. You've made his splendor to cease, cast his throne to the ground. You've shortened the days of his youth. You have covered him with shame. Now again, we don't know historically what event exactly the psalmist is talking about, but something really catastrophic has happened that the psalmist characterizes it as a rejection of God's covenant, a casting of the king's crown in the dust, and a rejection of his throne. And it seems to me that, you know, there were periodic incursions by some of the enemies of Judah, but this seems to me to be so over the top. Probably when the Babylonians came and carted the king and most everybody else off into captivity. And that leaves you pondering, well, where's God's promise? Didn't he promise that the throne of David would endure and so on? And so He doesn't know what to make of this, but he just says then, verse 46, "How long, O Lord, will you hide yourself forever? Will your wrath burn like fire? You know, where are your former loving kindnesses, O Lord, which you swore to David in your faithfulness?" And so he's just basically posing the question, you know, where are the promises of God? Why aren't they being kept like I would expect that they would be kept? That kind of question. Well, I think this is an important passage to consider, because I think all of us, if we live very long at all, will face difficulties in our life where we wonder, what's God doing? You know, you have a child that dies. Why did that have to happen? You know, doesn't God care about me? And what good does it accomplish in the grand scheme of world events and so on? But the thing is, I don't know. And I can't presume merely on that basis, because something happened I didn't like. Well, then there must be no God, or God doesn't keep his promises, or something like that. We just have to continue to have faith in God, and that there is an answer. And whatever that answer is, it's consistent with his love and his power and his wisdom. And that if we had the same insight that God did, we would do the same thing. And just trust him to do that. But, and that's what this psalm is an exercise in, and a reminder. Okay, first of all, Shane. Right.
And so often that, you know, we as God's people, as much as Israelites life back in the day, wanted to hold God's feet to the fire. And you said, you know, you give us this and you give us this. And so they pretty much took that as carte blanche that they could just, you know, do whatever, because they were God's elect. They were God's chosen. God not going to leave us. So it really doesn't matter whether we serve God properly or not. He said he's going to do this, and then sort of leave out the part where, you know, if you forsake me, I'm also going to punish you.
Right.
And when you look at these things, that should bolster, you know, on the hindsight, when you look back at it, that should bolster your faith in God, that God is just as consistent in what he says he's going to bless as when he says he's going to punish.
Right.
And through this, the people got what God had promised. They got the blessings when they served him, and they got the punishment when they didn't.
Right. Right. Janet?
Okay,
God knows exactly what he's doing, absolutely. And it's just one of those things that, you know, we know deep down that's true, but, you know, in times of trouble, our faith may be shaken, or we take our eyes off of God and we focus some more on our self-pity or something, and causes us to fall away. Well, the point of looking at this here is it's really irrelevant who the king sitting on the throne is. As if to say, well, if it were Solomon who was reigning when this happened, that Solomon could say, boy, I'm sure I'm lucky that God made that promise to my daddy, and I'm the fulfillment of that promise. I'm the son of David that has this confidence that my throne will be established. But boy, if it's, you know, Rehoboam or Asa or Jehoshaphat or Hezekiah or any of the other descendants of David, they have to say, well, that promise wasn't to me. It was to, you know, way back there to the ancestors, and it only applied to the first child in the line. Now, clearly, the perspective of the Bible is whoever's sitting on the throne of David has a claim to this promise. It's not just Solomon personally, his kingdom would be established, but David's kingdom, David's throne, whoever's sitting on it, is established, you see. And likewise, whoever is reigning on that throne and sins will be punished. That's part of the promise as well. And so it illustrates again that every king who sat on the throne of Judah was a recipient of this promise, a fulfillment of this promise, and every one of them was stepping into that role of king, and some of them were better kings, like Hezekiah and Josiah and so on. But then some of them were really rotten kings, like Ahaz or Manasseh and so on. So again, Psalm 89 illustrates it's not just Solomon that receives the promise. It's not just Jesus that receives the promise, but any that set upon that throne were heirs of that promise. And it isn't just the Davidic promise that works that way. If you trace out the promise to Abraham, you find the same thing is true. Who is the seed of Abraham? Well, it's the nation of Israel. But it's also Jesus. But it's also us. We are the seed of Abraham too. And so we have also received the promise. And so we are a great nation. And we have a land that God is taking us to and a rest that he provides for us that we have yet to receive because ultimately that is heaven. And so again, what I'm trying to impress you with is that's kind of the nature and tenor of how these Old Testament prophecies and promises work. And similarly, if we look at 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18, there's one other category of people we can throw into this. Now, I say apparently because it's not as explicit here, but again, how strong it is in the eye of the beholder, I guess you might say. But 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18, I will be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me. And that's an echo of 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 14. You don't find any other passage anywhere in the Old Testament says anything remotely like that, except that it's derived from 2 Samuel 7:14, and very similarly, Revelation chapter 21 and verse 7 makes a similar kind of play upon this connection. He who overcomes will inherit these things. I will be his God, and he will be my son. And so it seems as if, just as we mentioned a moment ago, that Jesus is the seed of Abraham and the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. But we also are the seed of Abraham and the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. In the same way, Jesus is the seed of David and the fulfillment of this Davidic promise. But we also, in some sense, are the seed of David and recipients and fulfillment of this promise. And then when you understand that, you start tracing this language throughout the New Testament in other ways. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. Are we sons of God? Yes, that's an expression you find used of Christians. The Bible say we will reign with Christ. Yes, we are a kingdom of priests, and so on. 1 John chapter 2, we have received an anointing, which sounds kind of mystical or weird, but what John is simply saying is, just as Jesus is the anointed one, the Christ, we also, in some sense, are anointed ones. We are all messiahs. Not the messiah, but messiahs. We have been anointed by God as well. And so this whole theme kind of really just permeates the entire New Testament. And so we have this kind of multiple fulfillment of the promise here. Now, before our time gets away, I want us to think about questions 3 and 4 here. And what I'm trying to illustrate is that elements of a promise don't always have to be fulfilled the same way for everybody who fulfills the promise. And so, for example, when you read this part of 2 Samuel 7, if the seed of David sins, I will chastise him. Can you see how that's fulfilled in the case of Solomon? Did Solomon sin?
Yes.
Okay, and God punished him?
Yes.
He started bringing his enemies in and invading him and caused him a lot of trouble. Now, if Jesus is the fulfillment of this promise, when Jesus sins, I will chastise him, does that seem to fit? Now, Jesus didn't sin, you know, and the promise isn't if, but when. And so when Jesus sins, but he doesn't sin. But you could say, is there some accommodative way we might say that part might apply to Jesus? Okay, he did become our sin, but it's not the same thing, is it? Solomon's fulfillment of that and Jesus' fulfillment of that are two quite different things. And the same thing is true of the language of forever. Solomon's kingdom is established forever. His throne will endure forever. He will reign forever. Well, not the way we normally use that word in English. Part of the problem here is the Hebrew word that gets translated forever You know, this is one of those things people say just sounds like they're making stuff up. But it doesn't always mean forever. It just means a long time, and it's a very relative term. So forever is not really a very good English word to try to translate this always. But on other occasions, this long time is quite literally, unceasingly forever. And you can easily see how in Solomon's case, Solomon reigned a long time, but certainly not forever. And yet Jesus does reign forever in a more literal sense, you might say. And I give you some examples of some passages you can look at here in number 5. We won't have time to look up those, but of interest is 1 Samuel 1:22. That's where Hannah says she's going to take Samuel to the tabernacle so he can serve the Lord before the Lord forever. Well, no, he's going to die before, you know, too long. But, you know, she really means you're going to spend his life in service to the Lord. But she knew that it was going to come to an end at some point. And you'll find other references there about how God's covenant with Israel was forever, or the sign of circumcision was forever. And, of course, there are a lot of people who point to passages like that and say, well, see there, we still are to live under the old covenant today, or practice circumcision or Sabbath keeping, because they are taking this language in a more literal sense, I guess you might say. So this kind of gives us a little bit of practice in how the Old Testament's used in the New Testament. There are hundreds of such quotations in the New Testament, so it's helpful to have some handle on how that works, and to be looking for that as you go through. And I would affirm that with rare exception, I can think of one or two off the top of my head, but most of the time when you have a quotation, you are well served to go back and look at the context of that original quotation and to see how its usage there is intended to help and inform your understanding of how it's quoted in the New Testament. Even when the quotation is being used with a twist to it, in a different sense, it's still playing off of that original usage, and so it's necessary to go back there and look at that. But what I have found, and I think this is getting better among God's people, but, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I know it was very common for people to say, you know, when they'd run across a passage and it would say, this was to fulfill that which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, people wouldn't even bother. Surely Matthew's telling me the truth. I don't need to go look that up, you know. Yeah, okay, it's in Isaiah there somewhere, fine. But then some real Bible students would actually turn to Isaiah and look at the specific verse and say, yep, sure enough, Isaiah was telling the truth, you know. Folks from Missouri, you know, the show me state, you know, I got to see for myself. Yeah, okay, yeah. But I never knew if when people would go back and not just read that verse, but read the chapter or the context and see what the whole thing was about, because if they had done that, they'd probably go, what? Matthew's completely misusing this passage. He's twisting it out, all out of context. But that touches on what we've been looking at in this class, looking at the context, not just of a specific text, but ultimately you have to consider the entire context of the Bible, because there is a sense in which the Bible is made up of different books written by different men. There's another sense in which it's just one book written by one author. And so everything that's said must be consistent and is a context for everything else that is said. Well, we'll have to stop there. On the back side, you'll see we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 7 on Wednesday evening, particularly the virgin birth prophecy. Could it be that that prophecy is like the promise to David, that it had more than one application or fulfillment? You know, something to think about. So that'll give you something to mull over, and you have the questions there. So we'll come back and discuss that on Wednesday. Thank you for your attention and comments.